I just want to kickstart something.
You want to kickstart something?
I don't know, maybe a haircut.
You want to kickstart it? You don't have enough hair. What do you need? 20 bucks? I can give you 20 bucks.
You think I spent 20 bucks on my hair?
Kind of looks like it.
Hey! I go into the city, thank you. I get people to do my hair. This has been styled, all right? And I just had it done today.
It's been styled.
Yes. You don't get that sort of salt and pepper move without getting it styled, all right? It's the Clooney. That's what I've got, the Clooney. It is the Clooney.
I think George would have something to say about that. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. Sitting beside me is your co-host, Ian Mond, or my co-host, Ian Mond.
No, I can be everyone's co-host. We could have a podcast where everyone is co-hosting with us.
Think about the words, Ian.
I do think, and sometimes I do think that people are with us in the room, spiritually, okay, talking with us and patting us on the back.
How have you been?
Great. Why are you trying to cut me off? I thought that was a perfectly sensible ramble.
Ah, less editing I have to do, the better these days.
Yeah, all right, whatever.
Do you have anything to bring to the table before we go and talk about the books?
I'd like to say yes, but no. My daughter turns one in a week, which dates this podcast straight away, to tell you that, because
they're all dated. They're all literally dated. Like, I actually put the date in the title.
I'm not the social butterfly in this room. I'm not the one who went to the Aurealis Awards.
I did go to the Aurealis Awards last weekend. I did not win. I did not expect to win.
Why not? You wrote a good collection.
I did, but other people wrote better ones, including Joe Anderton, who won Best Collection for the Bone Chime song.
Okay. I've not read that. Have you read it?
I have not. It's at home. It's on my TBR. Leaning tower of books to read, which requires some heavy scaffolding to actually keep it upright these days. So, yes, I will get to that one.
The trick is carving out time to read.
If you could teach me how to carve out time from nothing.
No, well, actually, that segues nice into Love is the Law, very occult, ex nihilo creation of time. You just have to, you know, say, look, I'm just going to read 100 pages every day. That's my view. I now read 100 pages every day. Sometimes I can't meet that, but it's now rare.
Do you catch public transport to work?
Yes, but I sleep
there
usually. No, I sleep on it.
Oh.
I don't read on public transport. I get sick.
That's such a waste of public transport.
No, it's my sleepy bus.
It's your sleepy
bus. We've had this conversation about the sleepy bus.
Okay.
And I can't read because I get nauseous and then start chucking up on the people next to me.
Yeah, that's not good.
No. So, what I do is at work I don't have lunch with anyone. I go on my own.
Oh.
You see. So people say, Mondi, you want to go and have lunch? Let's go to the local wherever. And I go, no. And they go, why not? I go, because I want to read. And they go, that's antisocial. And I go, yeah. And that's the conversation.
See, that's the problem. I don't work out of home, and I haven't worked out of home for years. And I used to get so much reading done on the train to and from work and during my lunch hour.
How hard is it for you to just stop at 12:30 in the day?
Really hard.
Okay.
Really hard.
No, look, you can do it, all right?
Yeah. Well, the problem is I actually need to get lots of reading done this year for the PhD. So leisure reading time will be at a premium, unfortunately. So I'll have to see. I need some time management stuff happening.
There's a nice course you have for time management skills. Do you want me to recommend one?
I don't have time.
What a start to the podcast. We're so witty.
Let's get straight into it.
Yes, okay. What are we doing
first? So the first book we're going to talk about this episode is the one you recommended, which is?
Love is the Law by Nick Mamatis, which apparently is the name of an album published in 1984 by The Suburbs, I think.
You did research.
I did a little bit. And I think I got the band wrong. All right. I could probably right now, we could pause this and I could check. But no, I want to go with that. Let's go with that.
Let's
not
go with that.
Artificially stop the podcast just so I can check. And that might be where the title comes from, or it might come from something else. I don't know.
I'd say it is, and it's probably also a play on the book.
Well, was I right? Is that the actual name of the band?
I don't know that, but it probably is, considering
where all the time it's set.
Yeah, and the music, all the music references. But also, it's also probably a play on, or an answer to, the Book of the Law, which is mentioned in the book, obviously. It's the occultism stuff that comes through.
So, music references. Mm. My musical knowledge is stunted at Bryan Adams.
Yeah, we know that. The world knows that.
I know, and I like to repeat it. And Meatloaf. Don't forget Meatloaf.
Meatloaf. Yeah. Original Meatloaf, or back in the 90s?
No, original. Bat Out of Hell.
Okay.
Come on.
You're not old enough.
What references did I miss musically wise in this book? Because I was missing stuff.
Oh no, look, I'm not au fait with the punk and metal scene in the US in 1989 either. But, but I just meant the explicit references of, you know, to punk music and metal music and the sort of friction between the two subcultures and all the bands.
Like, all stuff. Into it, because isn't this where sort of goth emerged from? What? What have I done now? You don't deny what you are and stop denying what you are.
Yes, I guess it does emerge from that whole alternative.
I mean, could you call Dawn, who's the main character of the novel?
She's a punk.
But is she a proto-goth?
No, she's a punk.
There is a difference. Because I don't understand any of this. So I know I'm coming off stupid and ignorant, but there is a divide between...
I mean,
are they causally connected in any way historically, is what I'm asking.
Well, yes. They all sort of came out of, you know, alternative music scenes.
You didn't expect to get this long questioning.
I did not expect to get this long questioning.
You've done no reading on this,
so you're going... I did not prep and go back to my industrial roots. No, so they did. It's all the... Oh, my gosh. If you want to get... No.
What?
No, I am not getting into discussion of 1980s, 1970s music and where punk and goth and industrial metal came from.
The reason I asked is because I've read a few young adult novels recently, and there are a few dystopian books out there, and here is Nick McManus.
I mean, she's very, like, she's...
You didn't let me finish the point.
Sorry.
You just jumped in there.
I did jump in there. Keep going.
Nick McManus has created what is a dystopian world set in 1980s America, but is actually a reflection of the time, but it feels dystopian.
It doesn't feel dystopian to me. It feels kind of like gritty realism.
Well, okay. Maybe we got to the point where gritty realism just equals dystopia, in my head anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So we should probably explain what the...
What is the book about, Ian?
I'm going to read off the back of the book. Unfortunately, it's a little bit sketchy. The Dark Horse, lovely book by Dark Horse, by the way. In 1989, punk rock girl Golden Dawn Seliger has crafted an outsider's life combining the philosophies of communism and Aleister Crowley's black magic. One fateful day, she finds the dead body of her mentor in Mr. Bernstein in both politics and magic, with a K,
yes,
shot in the head, seemingly a suicide. But Dawn knows there's more going on than the Long Island cops should ever hope to find. In setting out to find the murderer herself, she will encounter dark and twisted truths for which no book, study, or basement show could have prepared her.
I guess if you're going to put it into its biggest genre box, the broadest genre box, it's an amateur sleuth murder mystery.
Oh, come on. A noir?
Yeah, but that's what it is, right? It's
okay.
It's not a private eye.
So it's Angela Lansbury, except characterised as a...
I did not talk about tone.
Ah, okay.
Or style or setting.
This is when you say amateur sleuth murder mystery.
As opposed to,
you're thinking of a cozy.
As opposed to, no, as opposed to a private eye, as opposed to a police detective.
No, I'm just saying the amateur sleuth description reminds you of, you know, an old lady and the cozy and...
Doesn't remind me of that.
Is that because I've got weird...
I don't know.
...prejudices and assumptions?
No, but it's not a police detective, it's not a private detective, it's not someone whose job it normally is to investigate... crime.
Yeah,
it's an ordinary person who has found themselves in the middle of a situation and they, for whatever reason, want to find out what happened. That's the sort of box within the crime genre.
Except it goes well beyond that.
Except it's, it does. I didn't say that's all the book was. Very pernickety.
I don't know what it is with me today. Usually I just let you talk.
You're pernickety.
I'm not pernickety.
I think you've been reading Love is the Law a bit too much.
It's
I think a bit of Dawn is rubbing off.
Yeah, because what you, and I don't want to speak for you, but what you found potentially a little bit annoying about Dawn, I found quite empowering.
Okay.
She says she's a fucking genius. Not enough people. I'm being serious here. No, seriously. I mean, the matter sets the tone of this novel from the very first line, and you either accept that tone or you don't, in my view. When Dawn says, hey, I'm a fucking genius, and there's no sense of self-deprecation here, this is a true fact. From Dawn, you either accept that or you go, well, fuck this. I'm not going to read a book about someone who's that full of themselves.
No, that's fine. I mean, as a statement of fact, that's fine. She's not as smart as she thinks she is, but...
No, but I think that's also part of the point.
Mm.
She does get... I mean...
So she is not a fucking genius, really.
Yes, yeah, it's a potentially our ironic statement.
Oh, no, she thinks she is.
This is why I love this book, okay? Why I recommended it.
Yeah.
Now let's get to the heart.
I mean, she doesn't even put...
It is a layered novel because you've got that first sentence, I'm a fucking genius.
Yeah.
as the reader,
it's if not the last sentence, it's one of the last.
Yeah, it's towards the end. The last sentence is about her father's boiled.
Yeah, that's right. Yes,
yeah. Yep. But spoiler. So it's a layered novel in that, yes, she thinks she is, but you, the reader, is probably going to have judgment over her because we will judge her as a character. And as the novel goes on, especially when the magic stuff starts to prevail and when she starts to say things like, well, she early on says that she has a magic skill being invisible, but later on it gets quite full on where she thinks the things that are going on are directly related to people using magical powers.
Yeah, when she talks about the magic skill of being invisible, though, she doesn't actually mean that she disappears. She means
she's not noticed.
She just stops people noticing her.
Yeah, but it's still to her. It's
oh yeah, it is. But what I'm saying, she's not saying yes, I can make myself invisible. She's saying myself unnoticeable.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Just to make clear that that's not an explicit magical happening in a traditional sense.
And you could argue that because she actually isn't a fucking genius, or at least not as smart as she thinks she is.
I mean, she's smart. She's very intelligent.
No. Obviously, well, she's 17 or whatever. Yeah. Or very young. Because she's not as smart as she thinks she is, she's now attributing things she doesn't entirely understand to occult magical sort of stuff. Yeah. That's one way of reading it. But that's not necessarily the only way, and that's what I love. For a book that's 200 pages long, that's one of the things that I loved.
55,000 words, I think.
Is it? What, you counted every word?
Every word.
Wow, Kirsten.
Every word.
What you do for this podcast is astonishing. Is astonishing. That's what I loved about it. Oh, look, can I get my rant out of the way first?
Yes, get your rant out of the way.
Okay. It's not a bad rant about the book. So I just read The Golem and the Ginny by Helene Wecker.
Okay.
Highly praised novel. It was on the New York Times book show, which is where I heard of it. And now it's been, and it's gotten it's a fantasy novel. It's got a golem in it. It's got a ginny in it. It's based in New York in the 1920s. However, it's a very shallow novel in my view. A lot of people disagree with me, but I think so. I think that secondary characters are very Disney-fied, as I said in my review online, which you can all go check out. And I think she gets Jewish mysticism wrong. Okay. I think she sort of treats Jewish mysticism as if it's a secret spellbook type knowledge where any rabbi, if they've got the right book, can animate a golem. And she only mentions Kabbalah twice in the whole novel. That I did check because I was panicky. Whereas Nick Mamatis in this book, which is about occultism, throws in a word like klippa, which is a Kabbalistic concept, which is about the husk that is left over. Everything in it. So the divine emanation created the world. This is a bit of a lesson for you.
Okay.
And I'm doing this all off the top of my head. I'm a good Jewish boy. So the divine emanation, God created the world, and everything in the world has klippa on it. Everything. It's a sort of a barrier, a husk to pure spiritualism. And the whole point of life is to break through the klippa. Okay. So even the book, a book like Love is the Law, it is surrounded by klippa, and our job is either you can never get to the holiness of it and therefore you should not read it because it's wasting time and throw it away, or you can find something in it that is spiritual. But it's this husk that – and he gets it right. Nick Mamatis uses that and uses it a number of times throughout the novel. And this is a book about occultism. And what I loved is that he gets it right. But, of course, he should get it right. He's an author. Authors are meant to get these sorts of things right. Okay? They're meant to have done their research.
And they're meant to.
And they're meant to, if it's something of a culture that's not necessarily theirs, they should do their research and put that in the book. Helene Wecker, who is Jewish, it didn't bother. She just decided to give a perfectly vanilla, mainstream bit of bullshit about Jewish mysticism, which fucked me off. And now people go, oh, but Ian, it's just a fantasy novel. What are you expecting, a treatise on Kabbalah? It's a bit odd. And no, I didn't expect the novel to stop for 150 pages, but neither does this book stop for 150 pages.
It sprinkles its information. It contextualizes it as well.
It contextualizes, sprinkles, and does it in a way that you feel like Nick Mamatis knows what he's talking about. Whereas with Helene Wecker's novel, and again, we're not doing a podcast on the Ginny and the Golem, but Golem and the Ginny, but doesn't do that. And that's why I love this book so much, because you don't feel like it's not patronizing. It doesn't dumb it down, and it's not patronizing, and it feels real.
Yeah.
It feels accurate on a subject that's not particularly well known. I mean, if a lot of people talk about occultism, don't really understand it. And that's why I liked it. Whereas I could go on about Noah as well, the film, but I won't.
No, please. We don't need to even pretend that film exists anymore.
Do you see where I'm coming from?
Yes, no, I do.
There is still an obligation in my part, and we talk about cultural appropriation a lot, and there's an obligation on the part of the writer, even if they're not, even if they're of the culture, if you're going to use
Jewish
mysticism to tell your story about a golem living in 1920s New York, get it right.
Yeah, no, absolutely, I agree.
And this is not a book about Jewish mysticism.
No, that's
it borrows bits of it.
Yeah, it's part of it, but
and he gets it right, and it was just such a revelation for me that he got it right. I think, and I shouldn't be that surprised. I shouldn't be going, oh fuck, someone's used Clipper in a novel, Clipot in a novel, and got it right. Even used a Q.
It's like
when he's doing his transliteration from Hebrew to English, he's used a Q.
I know.
Oh, fuck me, aren't you a genius?
It's depressing, isn't it? Depressing when someone who's just doing what should just be.
It's
the done thing. It's like, Chris Rock, amazing.
Sketch? You know that Chris Rock sketch? You shouldn't be happy for things that you should, you know.
You should just have.
You should, you know.
Yeah.
Like the guy who's happy for not running off on his children and staying home looking after them.
It's like, dude.
And that's what I feel, you know, but no, but I love it because of that. And that's.
Is that the only reason you love it? Because it gets Jewish mysticism correct?
Look, obviously that's a personal thing of mine. And it isn't like
I can see how something like that will actually make you just love a book, though. Like if it's something that you're kind of you don't see, and when you see it, it's usually done badly. Then I can see why even just that thing would be enough to make you form a very strong attachment to.
At the same time, I don't know enough about Crowley to know whether all the other magic.
Well, I was going to ask you about that if all the. But you don't know.
No, I don't.
I don't know heaps about Crowley.
I thought you did. You're so disappointing sometimes.
Don't.
You've got a coffin as a coffee table.
The little that I did read about Crowley and Satanism, and his take on will and personal liberty and so on, just shat me to tears. It's such a selfish, self-absorbed view, and even the end game is just. Selfish. I just I'm sorry. It wasn't something. Yeah, it's something that kind of interests you, I guess, when you're 17, and then you start reading about it, and actually, it's like you're
which is
selfish bunch
of this novel
wankers.
Because it obviously interests Dawn.
Yeah,
I mean, to be fair to Dawn, dysfunctional family. How fucked's a family in this? I mean,
yeah, the family is pretty much fucked. It's pretty bad, especially when you get to the end.
Yeah, it's. I mean. See, this is one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book is how much do we blame Dawn's background, and is this about blaming? So she is the way she is, and you could call it obnoxious. You could call it you just want to punch her a few times because she's just annoying.
Oh, I didn't want to punch her. I'd give me a good shake every so often.
Why? Well, this is the thing. I want to ask you why.
I think Dawn is. I think she's quite a well-drawn character. I mean, she's sociopathic, clearly.
Because
whether
she
that's something,
on people?
Whether that's something she grows out of, I think you could probably make an argument that.
Well, why is she sociopathic? Because I mean, I don't think she puts on a face for other people. She seems to have
She doesn't. She doesn't have. She doesn't have a lot of sense of any kind of remorse or responsibility for actions that she does to hurt other people or that she even should, which is very Crowley. You know, this is obviously why she's attracted to Crowley's philosophy. Okay. And as I said, an argument could be made that the great majority of teenagers are sociopathic and they grow out of it as you become an adult and become more aware of your impact on the world and people around you. And it's not all just about you as you think it is when you're 15. But she's just... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she's a bully. I mean, as I said, I think Mamadas is making a very good portrait of her because she's feels very real. I mean, she even acknowledges at one point the fact that she's only ever beaten people up who she knows she can defeat. She's never taken anyone on who she thinks actually might beat her. So, you know, she's only beating people who are weaker than her.
Which is why she gets well over her head towards the slit of this novel.
But again, she's a teenager, and I don't think.
Yeah, but are you frustrated with her because you're frustrated with this sort of character? Because you don't.
A little bit.
Is it a reflection of what you were when you were that age?
No. Definitely not. It's a girly swat.
Okay. But do you think that's a false sense of empowerment then, as a female character? That you...
I think so. I don't think that. I mean, she, you know, quote unquote, strong female character, but you unpack those words, and it's not just about who can physically beat up someone else, who can yell the loudest, who can make the snarkiest comments, who can hurt the most people's feelings, who has the least amount of respect for anyone around you. That doesn't make you strong. I mean, as I said, as is kind of acknowledged, you know, in the book, she's not strong. She actually can't beat everyone. She can only beat up people weaker than her in some way. She can only exploit people who are weaker than her in some way.
And use sex.
And use sex. And again, she's – yeah, I don't particularly – I mean, I think one of the most depressing things about Dawn and – well, about the book actually, because it's not Dawn. Throughout the entire book, over and over and over and over again, she sees herself when she's drawn as – again, you have the exceptional girl. Right, she's the good female because she can do all these things, and she's being posited against almost. See all these blue little tabs that I've got in this book, my little post-it notes that I mark things up when I go through. I didn't mark your book up. Don't worry, they just put the post-it in. Didn't underline or highlight. More than half of them are actually where I was marking up how Dawn refers to other female characters in this book, whether they're passing references of generic things or whether they're specific female characters.
Well, they'd be mostly about her dad's girlfriend.
They're all the way through. Any passing reference to a woman is usually derogatory, and it's grounded in gendered observation. So housewives on Valium, women who – I mean, I could go through and list you a whole bunch. Like when she's spying on the women, the people she's spying on who she knows the names of are men. Oh, and the old Greek lady, who I guess when you get to be a really old woman – you're not really a woman anymore. So any young women or girls are described, even when she talks about how she herself is very comfortable with sex, although I don't think she is. I think most of it's a front. And she's trading blowjobs for Bernstein's knowledge, essentially. And there's a bit where she says, Bernstein had a nice cock and paid me to suck it. I was not a whore, though. I just needed the money and was patient with him, not like a whore would be.
Yeah, okay.
You know, she's very derogatory to pretty much any female who crosses her path, I guess as exemplified by the character we know as Chelsea, and is it Karen, the Korean girlfriend of...
Yes.
Yeah.
I think.
And the thing is, this is...
I think it is. I mean...
And the thing is, it was so... It felt to me...
But so I understood that, why she was derogatory towards the girlfriend. And also the girlfriend's trying to manipulate her anyway. I mean, there are plot reasons why...
Yeah, yeah, but she didn't know that. Like, there's automatic reaction. But this is the thing, right? Because okay. I'm reading the book and it felt to me so explicit and so deliberate that I'm suspecting that what Nick Mamatis is doing is playing this game, is showing it, because it's depressingly common for girls and women to be at least depicted. Psychology tells you in real life it's not always the way, and in fact it's much more common for women and girls to actually collaborate and have friendships, and the idea of the frenemy is actually mostly a pop cultural creation. But I thought, this is what he's doing. He's building this very sort of touchstony female character who is, you know, the good girl, not as in like, you know, behavior wise, but you know, she's the okay female. She's the one who's okay to be with because she's smart and tough and sassy and can hold her own and beat people.
You think
up
that's
and,
what he's creating? So I don't.
The other females are just vapid, or they're housewives, or they're sucking up, literally sucking up to men, or they're, you know, all of these sort of female stereotypes, I guess. And I thought he's working that line to undermine that at some point. And he never did, because actually in the book, as it plays out, it is all the men except Dawn who are active and have the power and are doing stuff. I mean, she wins at the end, but all the female characters. Yeah, yeah, but you know what I mean? It is actually all the men who have the agency and who are active and who are doing things. And any female who has agency is actually doing it under the control of a man. So the book actually supports Dawn's worldview that she is the only good female because she's active and has agency and is doing things, whereas all the other females are either just vapid, Valium-dosed housewives watching TV or too concerned with their little pet dogs or fashion or whatever, or they're girls who are just sucking up to men because they can't stand on their own two feet. You know, the book actually supports that. The book doesn't give us other female characters who may be antagonistic to Dawn and may be, you know, her opposition, but have their own agency.
So you're saying if one of the, like Karen, for example, actually had been the one manipulating her dad.
And not being manipulated. Exactly. It was depressing by the end of it because I was appreciating what he was doing because I've read Nick Mamatis's blog and various pieces he's done over the years, and he's an intelligent guy. He is aware of a lot of this stuff, and I thought this is what he's doing. This is smart. He's creating this character who's going around going, I'm the only good girl because I do all this stuff and all the other girls are just stupid. But, you know, I'm one of the boys kind of thing, even though she has, as you know, almost as much disrespect for almost, not quite, for a lot of the male characters as she does for the female ones. There's not as much venom in describing the male characters as there are describing
the
female
venomous
ones.
I think she. Well, see,
there's a lot more dismissal, less venom.
Well, you'll have to back that up with evidence.
Well,
I mean, yes, obviously, yeah. Like a character like Bernstein, she looks up to, even if she does suck his cock.
Yeah.
There's obviously a mentor relationship going, and he's a guy.
Yeah.
And you can't imagine she'd have a similar relationship with a woman.
No.
So I accept that.
Yeah.
But given how she throws men away, at least the ones who are less powerful than her.
That's what I mean. I'm saying there is a lot of Dawn disrespects just about everyone who she considers less than her, and she thinks everyone just about is less than her.
Because you call her a sociopath. I mean, she's more a misanthrope. I mean, she isn't an equal. She hates everyone. There's no one other than her grandmother, her demented grandmother.
And Bernstein, who she did care about.
Yeah, well, enough to try and figure out why he was murdered. Even there, though, it's a very conflicting situation.
Yeah, it is.
But okay, keep going.
But I think a lot of what Dawn says is kind of a front. It is a front to possibly mask the depths of her own feelings from herself. Because when you're growing up in obviously an environment that she has done, having feelings and having emotions and having vulnerabilities can be literally fatal. You know, you don't show that. You don't allow people to see anything that they could use to hurt you because they will hurt you. So you have to be brittle. You have to be invulnerable. You have to be the tough person. And that's what she does, and that's what she's been doing pretty much her whole life. So I think a lot of that is masking even from herself, or maybe I'm just hoping that.
Well,
is.
See, I don't agree with the argument that I see what you're saying, that she's very derogatory towards women. And you're saying, well, that's not undermined because her worldview is a sense bolstered.
It's supported by the book.
Well, part of it is.
It is supported by the book.
But not the – she makes comments about whores without – but there are no other whores in the novel.
No, that's
I use air quotes. No. Yeah. But she makes comments about the people she looks at, the vapid – the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, the main female characters are used and manipulated, and that is very sad. But that doesn't necessarily mean that her worldview is supported, just – her world, just that these particular women are being fucked over. Well, yeah. I don't know. Why are you laughing at me?
Because that's what the book is saying. If the world of the book are these people, where are the characters that disavow her worldview? Where are the characters that make you think?
Yeah, okay, fair
or
point.
Even make Dawn think at any point that all other females are just useless. And
I get the feeling that Dawn, it doesn't matter. I get the feeling
And what
well.
I'm saying about the venom is, with Greg and the other male characters who she alternatively uses and dismisses, and, you know, she describes them, you know, linguistically, the language is one of dismissal, and, you know, they're stupid, they're idiots, they have poor height, you know, they don't know what they're doing. With female characters, not so much the ones who are not sort of, I guess, you know, have speaking roles, to use film parlance, there is a viciousness there. There's lots of bitch and whore and dyke and cocksucker and things. And she doesn't use language like that when talking about male characters. She talks about their stupidity and how they don't understand what's going on. And, you know, I mean, and she's violent towards men and women. But, yeah, it doesn't seem to have – and, again, it's a social colloquialism, I guess, to use different language about men and women. You know, we all know the old saw about there just not being equivalent language for men and women in many of the ways that we use for insults.
Okay.
But yeah, I think, I mean, I did feel more of a venom and more of a viciousness in her even throwaway references a lot of the time about female characters. And as I said, I thought this was a deliberate sort of setup to, you know, not that I expect Dawn suddenly to come out at the end of the book and she's best friends forever with Chelsea or one of the other female characters, because there is that aching little start of a chapter in the middle somewhere where she says, you know, I apart from her grandmother, she doesn't have any women in her life. And when she first saw Chelsea, she kind of wanted to be a friend. I mean, it's very cleverly done. I just feel that he didn't go all the way, and he didn't give us a female character who would.
You're looking for a role model,
opposing.
In a sense.
No, I don't. Well, not a role model, but a character who's going to oppose
her worldview.
All women except her, because she's super special and a fucking genius, and is doing stuff the boys do. All other women are just either useless or inconsequential or completely unaware of what's going on in the world or are being manipulated
by
men.
But isn't it enough that Dawn has, it's a Pyrrhic victory? I mean, she gets completely fucked over by the end of the book.
Yeah, but everyone does. No one wins, really, except maybe Riley, if you wonder what he's going to be continuing to
do. She thinks Riley wins.
Yeah. But well, then it, not even Dawn is good then. Then all women are just useless.
Well, no, well.
But you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing there to. And as I said, I didn't care if Dawn herself came to any kind of a realization about how she thinks about other women and girls and how she sees herself as a female who is better than all the others because she's more like a boy. But I expected the novel to acknowledge it, and I didn't see it.
Do we have a disadvantage? Okay, taking that point, do we have a disadvantage that we didn't live in Reagan's America? And this, because there's quite a lot of commentary here about the Cold War.
Are you saying that in Reagan's America there were no women who had agency and were active except for Dawn?
No. But if you take this snapshot, no, that's not what I'm saying. Although maybe it is. If you take this as a snapshot of a particular slice of history, I've just said the same thing in two different ways. It seems to be pretty crushing in terms of – if you're of a certain socioeconomic class, it seems to be pretty crushing.
Yeah.
And Dawn is in the middle of that crush, and she's trying to find a way out of it through a cult and through, you know, trying to get – you know, through people like Bernstein. And should we be surprised that she has – two things. Should we be surprised or not that she has this view of other women and men to an extent, but women, and that to an extent it's even confirmation bias. It's confirmed in what occurs in her life, because that's the time and that's the place. And Mimatis has picked 1988 or 1989 America for that very reason. I mean, there's a reason why he picks that slice of history. I mean, why isn't it based in 2014? I mean, I know he wants to get the punk thing, and that's part of it too.
Wants to get the punk thing, and let's face it also, it's not set in 2013, because if people had mobile phones, half the shit that happens in this book would be over in the first 10 pages.
Fair point.
The internet and mobile phones have done a lot to
fuck up crime novels.
Complicate the writing lives of... of various genres.
Why not pick the mid-60s or pick 1970s? But there were angry girls in all those time periods. You know,
he hasn't got angry girls. He's got Dawn. And that's what I'm saying. Well, he's got Dawn.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I just think there's more layers here.
Oh, no, there are, but I don't think that theme there is. Look, I didn't hate the book. It was just it irritated me on various things, and I didn't love enough about it to. I guess it's just one of those books that, but at the end of it, I just didn't care that much that I'd read it. It was an interesting book. He did some very clever things that I appreciated.
See, when you say it like it sounds so clinical and in surgical,
I can't force myself to care about a book.
Well, I want you to. That's my role here, to force you to care about a book.
You know, by the end of it, it's like. Nah.
See, I loved the ambiguity around the magic side of it.
I like that. I like that you, because again, you have a very unreliable narrator who, she knows a lot more than she knows.
He never speaks down to you, and it's uncompromising. It's not like that she herself, Dawn, goes through this amazing character arc where she starts off miserable and sad and cynical and becomes, oh, but there might be hope, or even worse, just dies. I mean, it's obviously not going to happen because it's a first-person narrative, but, you know, that it's just uncompromising. She is what she is, and she is that for the duration of the book. I love that.
So did I. Like, as I said, I didn't want Dawn herself to do this transformation, but there's a difference between, and, you know, this book is written, so you realise that, you know, this is an author who has very close control over his narrative and what he's doing with it. And there's a difference between even a first-person narrator. There's a difference between how a character, even a narrating character, views the world and how the book lets you see that world. For instance, we can see Dawn is not as clever as she thinks she is. You know, when the bit where her mother's name is revealed, you go, what? What, she never put – really? She never – even after she found out Bernstein and her dad and her grandmother all knew each other, she never put together that he was calling her by her mum's name and maybe that was – you know, like, and that's fine because we can see Dawn, the persona of Dawn as she presents herself to us out of, because that's what her personality is, that's what she's built to defend herself from the world.
But all those revelations don't crack her.
No.
They little gaps.
No,
little
because
chinks.
She has this incredibly inflated sense of herself. But as most teenagers do, most teenagers know everything.
But okay, I'll tell you what it comes down to for me. You've gone essentially meh.
You've essentially said meh about this book.
Okay.
Yeah.
What it comes down to me is that I have not come across a character like this for that intense duration, maybe 55,000 words, but for that duration where it would just be so easy to say, well, she's had that revelation about her mother or whatever. That's a little chink in the armor and something's going to happen.
Yeah.
That's just bang. This is, yes, so inflated. She's a fucking genius. And it tells you at the front and it tells you at the end. And, you know, and that.
But as I said, I think the novel works very cleverly to undermine that.
Absolutely.
Not that I think many reviewers seem to agree. Like, I read a few reviews of this, and most people go, yeah, she's a fucking genius, and Nick Mamatis is a fucking genius. It's like, she's not a genius. She's a very smart 17-year-old.
Precocious? Is she precocious?
Precocious.
Would she be in the Famous Five?
Oh, my God.
Look, I love this book, and I will defend this book to the hilt. I see what you're saying about the gender side.
Look, I didn't.
I'm a man, so I didn't pick any of that stuff.
As
I'll
I said,
honest.
I didn't hate it. I was disappointed by a few things, and just overall, it was just. Put it this way: I'm glad it was 55,000 words.
Well, any longer, and you'd have shot yourself.
Yeah, I mean, but that was the length the book had to be, and it wasn't this, you know, huge, big, convoluted, you know, mystery novel that collapsed in on itself. I mean, I think he played with the coincidence motif very close to its edge.
Well, that's part of the ambiguity around whether it's magic or not.
Yes, exactly.
So he had his cake and ate it.
I think he did that quite well. I never kind of got to the point where I went, no, that's just one coincidence too many. He played that line of ambiguity and whether the coincidence was happening because they were magic or whether it was just stuff happening and Dawn sort of, you know, fitting them into the schema of her mind as coincidence.
You're essentially saying that you felt you saw too much of the artifice and therefore weren't as engaged with it as much as I was.
No, it wasn't.
Do you
even
love to put words in your mouth?
I love how you did that. No, it wasn't even. I mean, I see the artifice. I haven't been able to read a book without seeing the artifice for 20 years. As soon as you start writing, it becomes very, very difficult to just read a book as you did when you were 10.
Well, is that your superpower?
It's not a superpower. It's a curse.
Okay.
Often you can't just sleep. I used to be able to. Movies were my thing. Movies were my thing where I could switch off the analytical, critical part of my brain, which is why I never picked the end of The Sixth Sense or, you know, I just never did because I could switch off that part of my brain and somehow movies weren't getting filtered through that part of my brain that said story, 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 learn, learn, learn. But in the last few years, I'm doing that with movies too. So, yeah, narrative is dead for me as a form of fun.
Glad we still do this podcast.
Anti-fun.
Look,
that might be part of it. I have noticed over the last year that I don't read a lot. I don't read a lot of the, like, fluffy popcorn books.
So how does this link back? How does this link back to Lovers
and War? Because I think this is much. It's meant to be much more of a fun book. Like the reviews,
really?
The reviews I've read of it is like this book is so much fun. It's funny. It's like action-packed.
It's
like, oh, this just may not be the kind of book I like to
read. No. If people are reading this thinking it's a thriller minute carnival ride of a novel, then they've
it's kind of the tone of the reviews. Oh, and it's super smart, but it's much fun.
It's super smart, It's yeah. it's a smart writer writing, doing something. I'll tell you okay. Obviously, I love the book.
Mm.
You were a little less loving of the book. Yeah, you're more meh.
Dislike it. Meh is a good. I'm lukewarm about it.
Yeah, it's like, I hate meh. I hate meh as a critical.
Well, I did give you like 20 minutes of why I was meh. I didn't just go meh.
Fine. Anywho,
but it's just summing my feelings up. The book didn't make me angry.
I think it provides.
Didn't hate that I read it. I'm just saying I didn't connect to
for
it.
For our listeners who may not have, because we haven't spoiled it too much. For those who haven't read it yet, I still highly recommend it, in spite of Kirsten's words. No, because it is a very
Kirsten's reticence.
Yes, exactly. Because it's a smart book written by a smart writer with a character that you're not going to come across often. Probably for good reason.
You did come across characters like this a lot more often in film, in really tacky ways, like in that movie Sucker Punch.
Okay, well, right. It isn't Sucker Punch.
No, it's not Sucker Punch.
It's a much smarter.
But I should stress, I did not mean to say it was, but I think you find these violent, snarky, smart, strong female characters.
Yeah, but that could describe Buffy.
A lot more in film.
That could describe Buffy. Yeah. And I don't think it's that. It's very much a very angry novel about a very angry person who thinks very highly of herself and never, ever really breaks from that other than the odd little chink.
Yeah.
And
I think it's a really good character study. I think it's an intense novel.
Well, yeah, it is. And I think it's an intense novel. And if you're in – and it's only short. And if you're in for a bit of that, you should read it because you know, we always talk about, and we should end here because we'll go on for another hour about it, but we always talk about looking for new and different stuff out there in the world, not just reading the same old shit. Well, I think Nick Mamatis provides some of that. I think it provides a level of difference. It's not...
You know what? I don't know why. It didn't feel different to me.
Okay,
I didn't feel like, oh, this is so boring. I've read this a million times because I can't even put my finger on it, but it didn't seem to hit me in the same way that it has affected you and some of the reviews I read. It's obviously really kind of given people a gut punch and this is, wow, this is so out there and different and completely, and it didn't, and I don't know why. Like, I can't point to other books that I've read that are just like it, but it just didn't feel that new to me.
Okay, well, part of this is that of this podcast is that we don't always have to agree. Isn't that a little patronising? We don't always have to agree,
we
children.
We can agree to disagree.
Well, yes, we can and still remain friends. I'm not giving you a lift home, though, so okay. I'm sorry.
I'm not editing this podcast.
Oh, thanks.
No, I will. I will edit it. You're going to sound so stupid.
Like I sound intelligent. Now we move on to our second book.
Which we may not agree about either.
No, probably not. You recommended Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber. See, the problem is...
It's a homework book for me. Sorry about that.
Yeah, the problem here is that...
It's also a really good book.
As you know, as much as I like Nick Mamatis, at the moment he's not a classic of the genre in terms of a writer. Maybe in 30 years we'll be lauding him as one of the greats. Angela Carter, though, is possibly in that zone. Died young.
51, so that's young, yeah.
But, you know, most people would have heard of Angela, well, not most, but you, a half-intelligent reader would have heard of Angela Carter. I'd never read any Angela Carter, but I knew who she was.
Yep.
And so for me, attacking her...
But she's dead. She can't, like,
no, but hit it, but back. But usually the argument is, oh, but you just don't get it.
I didn't get Love is the Law, obviously.
Yeah, but it's different with Nick Mamatis.
I did not tap into...
What's Nick, you know, no one's going
to... He's capable of doing a lot more to me than Angela Carter is.
Well, maybe he'll...
I read his book.
Maybe he'll vilify you on Facebook and LiveJournal, but no one's going to say that you've attacked, you know, a writer of the ages, because at the moment
he's not. The sacred cow.
Correct. Whereas if you shit on a height on Angela Carter, which is not necessarily what I'm going to do here, because she's dead, as we said.
Hang on, wait. Do you hear that? The sharpening of knives.
You'll basically come off as someone who's a complete troglodyte cock of a reader. Yeah, more or less. This has been one of our more violent podcasts. I think it's to do with the Mamatis.
I think it is. I blame Dawn.
Anyway, you recommended it. Tell me why, Kirsten, apart from being a homework book.
So the Bloody Chamber, for those of you who don't know, is a collection of fairy tale revisionings that Angela Carter wrote. And she wrote it around about the same time she was translating some fairy tales by Charles Perrault.
Because these came around 1979, 1978.
They're different years. The Bloody Chamber was – the collection was first published in 1979.
Okay.
But a lot of the stories had been previously published and the the Charles Perrault collection was published in 1977, I think. Like, it was before The Bloody Chamber, but she was obviously writing these stories at the same time she was translating his fairy tales from the French. And so, you know, I mean, he has a Red Riding Hood, he has a blue beard, he has a Puss in Boots. I mean, they're the stories that she was working with. And so she is – obviously her head's filled with them, and she is working on her own revisionings of them. And so The Bloody Chamber is – it's a very short book. It's only got well, I can't actually remember how
it's
many
It's not as short as it looks. It's actually quite
– I told you it was dense. I told you it was a very dense book.
It is a very dense book. Yep. I mean, it pretends to be short.
Well, it's short in pages.
Yes, it's 130 pages.
But it's very dense.
Yes.
And
it's nearly dialogue-free in some instances.
It is. Dialogue was not her forte. Dialogue was – and she freely admitted that. She didn't have an ear or a pen, I guess, for writing dialogue. So, no, there's not a lot of dialogue. It isn't, and there certainly isn't a lot of what we would picture as sort of contemporary dialogue, where lots of interchanges down a page and she said and he said.
Nor is the writing contemporary in flavour.
Well, she is – actually, that's a little unfair. I was about to say, she is writing fairy tales, but, I mean, this is how, like, if you read other of her work, her work is very dense and very rococo. Yeah, Baroque, yeah. But it's sort of amplified in, I think, in her short fiction, because she sees, or she saw, short fiction as emphatically unminimalist. It wasn't the idea of a short story is sparse and short. And she saw it as a way to make this sort of Baroque, rococo object because it was only short. So it's like having a small slice of mud cake. You're not going to eat the whole cake. You'll be sick. But if you have a slice, even though it's really rich and really dense and you know, but you this can
is,
have a slice.
This is the key problem.
So that's how she sort this of is, this viewed is the short key stories,
problem.
I
yeah,
think.
And this is the key problem for me. This is not a book to read one story after the other. Guess what
no.
I did?
See,
I obviously for this podcast I've got to. I don't have the opportunity to read one month and one the next
Well, not
month.
A month, but you wouldn't. Did you sit in one sitting and read it?
I read it in a day and a half.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I probably did too. I mean, I first read
well,
it like 20
it,
years ago. Yeah, because it's been a long time since I read it the first time. Maybe not 20 years ago, maybe 15. And yeah, so I reread it and I love it even more.
You've got to set aside, and this is not a bad thing, this is not a criticism, you've got to set aside time to read it and think space to read
you
it.
You do, because she's writing She writes very deliberately in terms of language selection.
Yes.
And, you know, we could talk for hours and hours on all of the references and
no,
the symbolism.
Could.
And
you could, because I wouldn't have picked half of them up.
But the point is you don't have to. I mean,
no.
I think that the beauty of her language is that you wouldn't have to pick up a single reference to a Shakespeare or a poet or De Sade or even I don't think you even really need the resonances of the original fairy tales. I mean, they have resonance and it's a joy to see what she's doing with her tales. But I think they do read as stories in themselves. You probably could come to them without needing to know any of the references. I mean, I can't verify that because obviously, you know.
I look.
Very few people would is the point. Though.
I mean, this is new to me and I – you know, you could tell The Bloody Chamber was Bluebeard.
Or, yes,
you
know, I mean, very few people would come to these.
And I've not even read the Bluebeard. I can't remember the last time I looked at that particular story.
Yeah.
And it's pretty obvious. And it's nice that the last few stories are sort of a different take on the Red Riding Hood tradition.
Yeah, and there's Beauty and the Beast in there. And
yes, there's Beauty and the Beast.
Puss in Boots and a Snow White, I think.
I want to be clear on one thing. Puss in Boots is the best thing ever.
I thought you'd like that one. I thought if
that
you were going to like any of them, you would like that one.
That is a genius.
That's an incredibly funny, ribald
thank
sort
God
of
it's in
romp.
There.
It's right in the middle. It's like your reward.
Thank God, because it is a reward. It is. You go, oh, fuck, I can't do another one of these. And Puss in Boots,
it's hilarious.
It is genuinely Puss funny and, in fact, hilarious. Shows – not only that she's a very flexible – not flexible is not the right word.
Versatile.
Versatile, yes, thank you. Versatile writer, but has a sense of humour. Because
oh, she was incredibly funny
well,
by all accounts.
I would know
accounts.
That from reading The Bloody Chamber, the first story, and then the next few. Then I mean, maybe they've got some sort of dry humour running through them, but so dry I mean,
yeah, most of them don't because they're not funny stories. They're definitely not funny stories. I mean, the fairy tales they came from aren't funny stories.
No, I did – well, they're so earnest though. I mean,
yes.
given that they're inspired based on fairy tales, I thought she just put a little bit
of
lighten it up a bit, just a little something,
lighten it up a bit,
yeah, just a little bit,
lighten up all the rape and the incest and the killing of wives and the sacrificing of virgins and all of that. Lighten it up.
Yeah.
She does, though. I think...
Yeah, we put some boots.
No, I think... Okay, all right. In terms of, yes, none of the other stories have the playful, ribald humor that
the vampire one, which is, what's that based on?
No, that's one that kind of sticks out. It was actually, it was based on a radio play of her own that she wrote.
Well, that's bit funny because the army guy is so fucking clueless as to what's going on. That's in of itself humorous. But,
yeah.
But,
he has no idea. And he ends up killing the vampire completely.
By accident.
By accident.
I'm laughing because it actually is funny. Was that meant to be funny, though?
I think so. Okay, all right.
Okay. But yeah, they are. You're right. They are rich pieces of mud cake or little Fabergé eggs.
Little Fabergé eggs. That's a nice way of putting it.
Yes. I have my moments. But they're not to be read one after the other. And that is
some of them are, though. I think you need to read, The Courtship of Mr. Lion and The Tiger's Wife as a pair, because they're both Beauty and the Beast stories, and reading them as a pair I think is really informative. And in the same way, reading the Red Riding Hood cycle as a cycle is really interesting to see what she does with the Red Riding Hood motifs and the werewolf themes and so on. You know, you could read The Bloody Chamber, which is a Bluebeard story, and I think that's the longest one in it, probably by far. And you could put that aside, go away and think about it, come back. Because they are, as I said, they're incredibly dense, and her use of language is incredibly careful.
Can I ask one question on the Bloody Chamber? Again, I have not looked at the Bluebeard Legend for a long time. The fact that the mum turns up at the end telepathically called to save her daughter.
She made a phone call.
Yeah, she made a phone call.
And her mum went, something's wrong. She went.
But not only turns up, but comes gun-toting.
I know, because her mum was a big game hunter. That line is perfect. But let me read you, in case you've forgotten, Ian, and for people who haven't read it. It's one of my favourite. I mean, I love The Bloody Chamber. As a story, I absolutely love it.
It's so goth, Kirsten. Of course you love it.
Oh, I'm so
thank God I'm driving home.
Anyway, it's the paragraph where her mother comes in, and it's just, and this I guess is an example of her prose. So the paragraph is, on her 18th birthday, my mother had disposed of a man-eating tiger that had ravaged the villages in the hills north of Hanoi. Now, without a moment's hesitation, she raised my father's gun, took aim, and put a single irreproachable bullet through my husband's head. I mean, it's just.
There are magnificent moments. Yeah. I agree. I mean, there's some beautiful writing.
But that is like the mother arriving, the mother who is a powerful, active character with agency and smart. She picks up that there's something wrong in her daughter's voice and hightails it over to find out what's wrong.
Forces her daughter to marry off some rich
bloke. No, she doesn't force her daughter. It's very much her daughter's choice.
Yeah, right. Fine.
I mean, this is unlike the Beauty and the Beast stories, the father does give the daughter to the beast. Yeah. This is very much about the daughter. This is very much about this young girl.
I don't know what you think. I hated these stories.
Who wants to get into this, and despite all of the little doubts in her head that niggle at her, she keeps pushing them aside, but the story is so, like, her language is so clever. There's that bit when they're in the carriage going to his island where his castle is, and the description of the nightgown that she's wearing that is, you know, pushing itself between her thighs, and it's incredible writing, and the recurrence of
very sexual and erotic.
Absolutely, absolutely, and the recurrence of the lilies all through the Bloody Chamber, and the mention of lilies and other flowers of death. And what I love about all her writing, not just the Bloody Chamber, but she's incredibly visceral in her prose, and she uses all of the five senses. There's smells and sound and touch. Like everything is tactile, and you hear stuff and smell stuff and taste stuff. It's not just perceived what through the eyes, and all of her writing is like that. And I think in these stories, because they're short and because they're not condensed, well, condensed, but condensed like, you know, condensed jus or soup or something, not condensed as in, you know, abbreviated, they're just really strong, and the imagery is so powerful in all of them and unified within each story. But also, considering they were written disparately, they weren't written as a collection. The way the stories do flow together is quite remarkable.
Look, at the end of the day, I didn't read these the right way. Because I did get to, I got exhausted.
Rushed through them.
No, I didn't rush.
Pushed yourself through them.
I felt towards the end I got exhausted. Like, for example, the first Beauty and the Beast one, the Lion.
Courtship of Mr. Courtship. Lion.
I love that story.
Yeah.
I do love that story.
It was really great.
I liked it more than The Bloody Chamber, which just felt, I'm thinking too much of how this story would have been written today. But
this is not like 1979. This isn't like old-timey.
Well, that's right. But that's the thing.
Yeah, she's writing in this particular style in a way. I mean, because she's it's not exactly clear time-wise where each of these stories are set, but they're not set in the 70s. But they aren't set in the 1600s either, most of them. And she's writing to give you a sense of time and place without actually specifying really a great sense of time and place. She's writing in this style, which is reminiscent of, you know, this timeless fairy tale kind of voice.
Yeah.
In the way that only she could kind of write it.
At the end of the day, it does come down to a limitation in my brain. And that's.
But if this is not the style you like, if you don't like this really dense Baroque style, then you're not going to like them. And it doesn't mean you didn't get them, and it doesn't mean you're not a good reader. It just means you don't like any more than I didn't really enjoy the style of Love is the Law. I saw what he was doing, and he did it really well. He accomplished what he set out to do, quite obviously, but I didn't connect with that. And you didn't connect with this.
Yeah, but I connected with Puss in Boots.
Did you like Puss in Boots? You liked him licking his arsehole, didn't you? His leg like a ham bone in the air.
I love that.
I thought you would like that. Well,
are there more like that by Angela Carter? Or is that an anomaly in her?
No, look, she's written. I can't remember.
Because I don't know a lot about her.
Several novels and other short story collections. And they've got like the Infernal Design Machines of Dr. Hoffman are sort of her take on Desaad, because she was also really interested in Desaad.
Okay.
I mean, he's referenced in a couple of these stories as well, and she was, you know.
Well, I did feel, because I've just read Delta of Venus by Anais Nin, which is another novel.
Yep.
It's a set of erotic short stories. Mm-hmm. Another book you should not read in one day because, well, there's only so much erotica you can take mentally before, you know, especially if you're at work in the cafe. It's not a good – that's a very funny story about that, but I probably should leave it for some other time.
I love short stories. Everyone who listens to this podcast knows that. They're my preferred delivery for written fiction, actually. And when I think about my favourite bits of fiction, you know, there would be short stories over novels. And I'm much more inclined to, unlike apparently almost everyone else in the world, according to the wisdom of contemporary publishing, I'm much more likely to pick up a short story collection by someone I don't know anything about than a novel. Because, you know, there's probably going to be at least one thing in there I'm going to enjoy. But no, I think the thing about most short story collections is, A, very few of them are written to be that collection. Very few.
Yeah.
There are some.
Yeah.
And we've reviewed a couple on the podcast. But very few are written to be this extant collection of short stories. Most short story collections that are published will be collecting work that has been written at various times and published in diverse publications. And there might be some new material in a collection. It's often the case. The author will put in a couple of new stories that haven't been published before. But they're rarely written as a complete work. So why do we think we need to read them?
I know.
In the same way as a novel.
I know, you're right. We just do, because and people do talk about dipping in and out of short story collections. I suppose for this podcast, it's an artificial situation where I've got no choice. This is definitely a book, and I recommend this to others. Given that the style's not for me, I still can see there's some beauty. I mean, I was just flicking through it now, and I look at The Tiger's Bride, and I realise, shit, I actually love this story too.
It's a beautiful story.
Well, it's also got a bit of steampunk in it.
Does it?
Well, there's an automaton, isn't there? Isn't that the one with – is it that this one or the lion? I got the Beauty and the Beast ones confused a bit, but that there's a replica of the girl.
Yes, this is that one.
Yeah, and it's essentially an automaton.
Yes, because he's going to make that to keep –
And I just call that steampunk now because you know,
that's, I don't think it's steampunk.
Well, given what century it's set in, you know. It's
Anyway.
What point I'm making is, when I look at them, I flick through them now, I realise that actually individually, the last few, the Red Riding Hood ones definitely had no impact on me.
Okay.
But there's no doubt the Puss in Boots, the two Beauty and the Beast ones, and yeah, the Bloody Chamber to an extent, they're fine pieces of work. I can definitely see it. And if I was reading them in isolation – or the Beauty and the Beast two together, because I think they work really well together.
Nice pairing.
And that was all I was reading. I'd be glowing about this. But I got to a point where I just thought, oh, fuck, I can't be bothered now.
That's kind of what I got to with Love is the Law. It's like, yes, it's a good book, but it's not for me.
Like the Earl King. The Earl King just, oh, fuck, what is this?
Well, the Earl Kings are sort of inspired by, not by a fairy tale, but by folklore and mythology.
Which I don't know. I've never, and not, see, that's one story.
Like a goblin king.
Yeah, but that's one story I think you need to know the background before you can read it, because it's just
too. It's told in a very strange way.
And it's diffuse, but it's so diffuse.
It's probably my least favourite in it, because I think the point of view shifts are actually fairly, they're more awkward than they should be. Yeah, I'd actually completely forgotten about the Earl King. That's what I mean. Like, I've read these years and years and years and years ago, like definitely more than a decade. And stories and images and things had stuck in me all that time. So then I read them again. They were familiar, whereas I didn't even remember the Earl King. That just got vanished. My brain just said, yeah, you don't need to know that one. That wasn't so good. I really like the Snow White story, yeah, too. That tiny little one.
The one that ends with It Bites?
Yeah. I mean, that's a beautiful little prose poem.
I like that because it's about 700 words. And then you've got the one after that is the vampire one.
Yes.
The Lady of the House of Love is again, it's a bit of humour in it. It's fun, but it just felt by that stage I was so exhausted. I thought, well, why is this as long as it is? It's a bit of a joke. I mean, it's essentially a tall story. You know, vampire lives in has pissed everyone off from the village and basically feeds off through the passers-by who come through and feeds off them, and that's it. And the rest is just aesthetic.
Yes, but it's aesthetic that makes the story.
I know, and if you're in the mood for that, you will gobble it up.
Absolutely.
Because that stuff you're talking about, the sensory stuff, is there in abundance with the flowers and just that feel and the sense and that she's young but old and all that.
You can really – like these stories are so remarkable in the way that they do engage – they do engage all of your senses. And I think one of the reasons I really like them in particular is because of that. Because, I mean, I think we've talked before how neither of us really are particularly visual readers, in that we don't tend to picture the scenes as we go along.
Poor conceptually.
But this kind of writing really does work for me, because I do find myself hearing when she describes the tinkling of crystal and calling to, like, evoking smells and sensations and stuff. So I think actually doing a lot more than just describing what characters see does engage my brain a lot better than, if it's a lot more sparse writing. I think because it's constant. I think she would almost engage all of the senses equally throughout her story.
Whereas, even though I read it as an e-book, I found myself flicking. How long does this have to go? You've got to be in a state of mind and in a mood. And I think you're wrong comparing it to the Mamadis in that sense, because the Nick Mamadis is far more engaging, isn't it?
Not for me.
Yeah, we see that just because you're wrong.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, different.
It's not fair anyway. One's a novel, one's a slightly, novella/novel. The other one is a short story.
But different styles of writing are going to engage people in different ways. When I recommended this one, I didn't expect you'd love it. I was hoping you might.
No, but if you look at it on a hit rate, I actually like the majority of the stories.
Yeah. You read them too quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. And with short stories, I think that's the thing. It's not that you need to.
It's a book you don't read on the toilet.
No. Well, I hope you're not taking your iPad on the toilet.
Let's not talk about that. Okay. You just don't touch my iPad. Like, I love The Bloody Chamber. I could, it's good. It doesn't do it for me, but Courtship of Mr. Lion, I enjoyed. The Tiger's Bride, great. Puss in Boots is my favourite thing ever. Probably anything I've ever read ever. That's how much I love it. Definitely just read Puss in Boots if you're going to read this. Lady of the House, okay, Earl King, Snow Child is so short it's hard to rate, but yes, it's cute. Lady of the House of Love. Okay.
That's a really bad word.
Lady of the House of Love is actually not bad, but it's just too long for me. For what it is.
Yes.
The Werewolf, The Company of Wolves, and Wolf Alice. I
loved Wolf Alice. That's one of my favourites.
Good luck to you, because it's, nah.
But it's a wolf child story.
So, yeah.
It's beautiful.
And?
Oh, no, you are wrong.
Believe it or not, just because something's a wolf child story.
No, I really like Wolf Alice. I think it's a visceral story. And I will also say that the other thing the more obvious theme that runs through all of this and all of Angela Carter's work really is her exploration of the representation and performance of the feminine. And that's what she's definitely doing with these stories in The Bloody Chamber, because I guess she's bouncing off the fairy tales. And she's very much anti-passivity.
because the women in this, for the most part, not every story, for the most part, have some form of agency. Bloody
yeah, that's all. And but that's what she's very interested in exploring that, and she's interested in exploring female sexuality. And I think Wolf Alice is really good because you have this girl, and it doesn't flinch away from this child who has grown up among wolves and then taken and raised poorly in human society and then abandoned because the nuns who take her in don't know what to do with her after a while, and they abandon her to a duke who turns out to be a werewolf. Spoilers. But it's this story which it doesn't just gloss over this child growing up to be a young woman. You get her struggling with this human body and what happens to it and not knowing what happens to it and not having any other women around to explain things. And again, it's a really beautiful story. I don't know why you don't like it. You're just wrong about that, Ian.
Oh, I just lost. Oh, look, it's the last story.
You were worn out by then.
I was worn out. I'd read two other stories, yeah. Not on the same theme, but on the same, I mean, about werewolves or wolves or lycanthropy in some way.
Which was a deliberate placing in the collection.
Oh, yeah, I can't understand. Yeah. And I just thought, yeah, whatever.
I think that's the best of the three wolf stories, actually. I think Wolf Alice is fantastic.
And whereas they're all blue. In fact, what you just described to the story, I only read this a few days ago. I'd forgotten all that. honestly.
As I said, with short stories, it's not – and when I said they're not meant to be read as a whole, doesn't mean you can't, like, you know, read them cover to cover without reading a book in between. But you don't necessarily – they're not like chapters in a book. You don't finish a chapter, turn the page and start the next chapter.
No, you need to look.
They're their own works in themselves.
You need to take a gap.
And for me, like I wouldn't read a short story collection cover to cover without a pause between short stories any more than I would finish a novel, immediately pick up a second novel and start reading it. I mean, even if the pause is just like 15 minutes.
No, you're right.
You know, because a short story, as I said, unless it's a collection has been done deliberately as kind of a mosaic novel, or in a way like Lisa Hannett's collection that we reviewed a couple of years ago, where it's not a mosaic novel, but the stories managed to build on each other so successfully. But even that collection I couldn't read in, you know, like in a single go. Whereas a novel, if you have the time, you can sit down and read in a single go because it's a whole story. That's what you do. Yeah. I think people do, I'm not saying you, but I'm saying I think, you know, people who read a short story collection in one go without, you know, as though it's a novel, as though the short stories are chapters, I don't think they're doing themselves any favours, really.
Yeah, well, this and reading The Delta of Venus by Anais Nin has really highlighted the fact that there is a way of reading short story collections,
yeah.
Some, and in fact most even, as you've just said, that doesn't that is different to a novel. And, I mean, you'd think at the age of 40 I'd have figured that out.
I mean,
no, but what you're saying sounds so obvious. I mean, obviously, short stories, they're a complete fiction. You need to have that gap. But we're in a society now anyway where we just read. Well, if we're readers, assuming we're readers, we don't pause. Who pauses?
Who pauses?
I mean, but I literally go from one novel to the next and there'll literally be a minute gap.
Oh, I see.
Because especially if they're a Kindle thing, you literally
don't
just,
you like to just
turn off to
think about them though at the end. Don't you like to just pause and reflect?
I don't need to because subconsciously it's stewing and I know I'm going to put a review up. Yeah. And so I'm going to go back to it and it'll stew in the back of my head. That's how I see it. Okay. Now, this fiction isn't written for that sort of stewing. Mm. It's written to be – there's an expectation, probably not an overt one from Angela Carter, that you stop and you consider.
Well, certainly when they were all written, as I said, they weren't written for this collection.
Correct.
So every story was written to be read on its own.
Correct.
Without following up with, oh, here's another angle on that.
Yeah.
That tale. When the collection was put together, it has been, you know, carefully arranged in what has been presumed to be the best reading order. But it still doesn't mean you go cover to cover and don't break between.
And I don't want people to think that if you've not read Angela Carter before, you should not go there because
no,
there is
please
some,
don't.
There is some beautiful stuff.
Don't think that.
But I think just be warned that this is not something. If you're like me and you don't, assuming you're like me, and there are many who are, and you, I'm kidding, and you don't like. Well, you've got some issues with Baroque, dense writing, then because you're simple in the head, like me. Then yes, you may want to be careful not reading this in one go, or over 2 days.
All right. Well, just set it aside.
Or read something in between.
Read something in between.
Yeah.
Have these stories as palate cleansers.
Yes. Puss in Boots is definitely a palate cleanser.
Puss in Boots is fun. Puss in Boots is – I do like fun. It was fun. Puss in Boots is a lot of fun.
Yeah, you do. Well, see, that is a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun.
Yes.
I think
but you cannot call that, see, that concept of fun does not relate to love as a law concept of fun, and love and law is not, because love and law is not fun. Puss in the Boots is,
I don't know,
is Angela Carter, you can tell, is laughing her ass off while she's writing Puss in the Boots.
You don't think Nick Smartis is having a lot of fun with that book?
He may,
a lot of fun with Dawn?
He,
really?
Yeah, from a writerly point of view, possibly yes.
Yeah.
But I don't think
what
he's
writing.
What
does that mean?
No.
Angela Carter having fun from a writerly point of view.
Yes, but she's also expecting the reader to have lots of fun with the story. I don't think. See, this is where this is my
own. A lot of
different.
Reviewers had a lot of fun with that book.
And I think they're silly. I don't think. I personally, getting into the head of Nick Mamatis, well, I don't know why we're back with him again, but getting into the back into his head, I don't know if he's sitting there thinking, shit, this is a real jape. this is a laugh a bit. People are going to love this. It's going to be so much fun. Wow. Forgettable in its funness, because I still think about love as a law.
Just because something is fun, does it make it forgettable?
Or disposable.
Or disposable?
Often in this society, yes. Most people think, when they talk about a fun story, they often think of something like, yeah, it's fun, but that's all it is.
Really? Isn't fandom built around fun?
Oh, duck, really doing it? Do you want to go there?
Seriously, though.
Fandom of the 1950s might have been. Fandom of 2014 is built around arguments, flame wars, Twitter, and the usual shit. When was fandom, seriously, when was fandom ever really fun?
You don't think people who really love steampunk, they're not having fun, they don't think their books are fun.
There's the initial entry. There's the initial entry of fun. Then you start meeting people.
You know, they're going to go to Supernova having fun.
The first two people you meet you like. And then you start talking to them,
but
that's
even
nice.
We're not talking about the people. We're talking about the stuff that they like. Yeah, you don't think they're finding it fun. People who like Batman comics.
You said fandom.
Fun.
You said fandom. Fandom is a group of people. If you're doing this in isolation and all you're doing is reading this stuff on your own, then yes, you can on your own in isolation have fun on these things. The moment you go into fandom and the nest of vipers that exists there, for it is a nest,
but it's
and they
built
are vipers,
on fun. It's built on things
built
people
on a
find
it's
fun.
It's built on a very shaky Los Angeles-like bedrock of fun where it just needs one little flick of the switch. And the whole fucking thing collapses, and you're left with people yelling at each other and flame wars, and just look at the last 12 months. All right? There ain't fun. How many people are walking in fandom at the moment saying, "Well, this is fun?" It's no one.
No, but I think the thing is that they read what they read because they think they're fun.
In isolation.
And they watch what they watch. And they...
In isolation. The moment you watch an episode of The Blacklist and then go online to talk about it, the fun ends. Or Doctor Who or anything. I picked The Blacklist because we were talking about that
but
before.
The point was that you said... You thought people who
you
looked
said
at
fandom.
Things
you changed
no,
the
no. You said people who looked at things as being fun looked at them as being disposable, and I don't think people who are fans of something see those things as being disposable.
Oh, okay, we've reframed the argument. Well, what point? I've completely gone off the topic. Yes, you're right.
Right, I think a lot of people
read or watch stuff
because they think they're amazingly fun, and they don't think
they're
disposable.
I never make generalizations.
Something that makes it that something that's incredibly dear to them.
I never make generalizations. I may have made them in this instance, and it may even be a completely false generalization.
Whereas I'm just anti-fun. Let's face it.
Except for Puss in Boots.
Except for Puss in Boots. But it's not my favorite story in the collection. In fact, it's my can I say least favorite? It's down the bottom.
What?
Yeah.
OMFG.
Yep.
Well, on that note,
it's not that I don't. I love it, but I love the others a lot more.
Nah, you just.
This is different types of reading. We read for different reasons.
No. Yes.
Yes, we do.
Are we different?
Yes, we are different. I'm going to call it there.
What are we doing next
month? We're going to code this at 11:23.
Yes, what are we doing next month?
Next month. You mentioned the Aurealis Awards at the beginning of the podcast. I thought we might go back and remember how a while ago we did that Hugo thing and we talked about the books that were nominated. So we didn't recommend
we're never
books.
Doing that again.
Yeah, well, two of the books that won awards I want to read. So we're going to do it. So what I've chosen and Ian agreed with is Lexicon by Max Barry,
yes,
which won the Best Science Fiction Novel at the Aurealis Awards last week. And then Fairy Tales for Wild Girls by Alice Near, which won the Best Horror Novel and also the Best YA Novel at the Aurealis Awards last week.
Incredibly bloody good if there are two judges.
Yes.
So
we're going to do those two, neither of which I've read. I believe Ian may have read Lexicon.
I've read Lexicon,
already,
yes, and
that's
I think quite fondly of it. Not spoilers.
Okay. I don't think we're meant to spoil our own podcast. We're meant to spoil other people's books.
I blogged on it too, so.
So that will be next month. That will be sometime in May, sometime before the end of May. Lexicon by Max Barry and Fairy Tales for Wild Girls by Elise Neer, and both of which, obviously, as they won the Aurealis Awards, are Australian novels. So that will be cool.
We're doing Australia Month.
Yep. I don't think we've done that for a while.
Yeah, no, not for a long time.
Anyway, so as usual, you can send feedback, should you so desire. We'd love to hear from you by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can email us via writerandcritic@gmail.com. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter, where we are at writerandcritic, and you'll get Ian if you talk to us on Twitter, because I don't usually log into the account except to ninja upload each episode. And also, if you love us, leave us a rating on iTunes. That would be lovely. And I think that's it.
Until next time, it's bye from me. And it's bye from you.
I don't get to say goodbye myself.
You can if you'd like.
You're very overbearing. You've been very pernickety. Pernickety and overbearing. Bye, everyone.
Bye. If I told you how much I do pay for my haircut, you'd lose it. Let's just say it's not $20.
Alrighty, you might need to kickstart the haircut.